This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, rumors about a possible disruption of a future Mecklenburg County Commission meeting causes one commissioner to call for ICE agents to be in attendance. We knew Republicans in Washington intended to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Now we know what they want to replace it with. Not everyone is happy, including some Republicans. We hear about reaction from our delegation in Congress. Work is still underway in Raleigh on a repeal of HB2. We get an update on where that stands. And two lawmakers are trying to kill the I-77 toll lanes. Again, our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more. We're joined by Tom Bullock from WFAE News. Good morning.
Good morning.
Glenn Birkins is editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com.
Welcome. Good morning.
Nick Oxner is a reporter for WBTV News.
Hello,
welcome
hello.
Back. And Ann Doss Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, rounds out the panel. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
You can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at @CharlotteTalks. Use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. A week or so ago, Charlotte City Council had to prematurely end their scheduled meeting because of protesters shouting them down, calling for city leaders to support immigrants. This week, acting on what I understand is a rumor, a county commissioner suggested taking precautions that the same thing would not happen to that body at its next meeting. That commissioner was Jim Puckett, who was quickly backed up by Commissioner Bill James. Where did this rumor come from?
Well, I think you could argue that they were fanning the flames, that they were there was no movement to have a mass turnout there, even though that actually would have made more sense. We talked about that last week, that the county is actually more active in pursuing deportations than the city.
But because for some reason, sheriff's office participates
right,
in that.
But the city gets all the attention, so they had, in this case, negative attention. So Jim Puckett and Bill James sent this email saying, we need to be ready if there's disruption. You know, we respect the democratic process, but if they get disruptive, we need to be ready to get them out. And maybe we ought to have ICE agents there in case they're illegal. This email got copied to reporters. It got reported online that day. And so nobody showed up to generally protest the sheriff's office, but they did have some people who showed up to protest the way they were handling that, saying that this is really not good when you have public officials essentially trying to squelch the democratic process by making threats to bring in federal
Tom
agents.
Bullock.
Yeah, and one of the things that was really interesting here is that Puckett made the step of requesting ICE agents actually show up at the meeting to keep the meeting peaceful. And ICE responded back, no, that's not our job. You can do it yourself. And it was just really fascinating to watch this because I can't think of another time where you've had a county commission member or any local government member asking a federal agency to come and enforce local law that's not in their jurisdiction, based on a rumor.
We're learning civics. The police department says that they don't enforce federal laws. They enforce local laws. The sheriff's department doesn't enforce any law. It just puts people in jail. And ICE is a federal agency, but they're not law enforcement.
But I would point out again that there's no sign that he actually called ICE or asked the county manager to put in a formal request. He sent an email saying, wouldn't it be great if we brought in ICE? And again, this is a really hot political topic.
Yeah.
And if you're a Republican, that, you know, we're getting tough on immigrants is a popular message. And
well, both these guys are Republicans. Jim
they
Puckett
are both Republicans.
And Bill James. So is it just throwing red meat to the base? Is that
I
all
think
this is?
Arguably, that's part of the strategy there. You could see Trevor Puller, you know, going very strongly against this, and you could kind of see Jim Puckett in the background just kind of with this little grin on his face, like, yep, this is playing out.
Glenn Birkin.
I think that was part of it. But the other thing we have to consider is that maybe they actually did think that there would be some disruption, and they were sending a message out.
Well, Bill James wrote that if we allow this group to do what they did to the city council, we will be setting an inappropriate standard for other groups who will want the same lenience and ability to disrupt. He has a point, doesn't he?
It is a very good point. I mean, and we've seen this happen at council meetings, at least probably a half dozen times over the last year or so, is that literally council meetings cannot continue because of the mass disruption from the crowd. And I think that is when you cross over from, you know, democratic protest into just, you know.
But the message was in that they were going that in theory they were going to invite ICE in. They didn't say we were going to have more police officers or sheriff's deputies. They were sending a message to the undocumented community.
don't come because you'll be arrested
ICE. It would be extremely smart to have a behind doors discussion saying, if this happens, here's what our security is going to do, here's what the sheriff's department or the police department is going to do, but we're not going to throw this out there and essentially taunt them or dare them to come
but
shout at us.
But stop me if you've heard this before, but last I checked, protesting is still not only legal in this country, but part of the democratic process. And what worries me is if this just was a game or if this is a message that they want to send, whatever the motive, you know, if you're an elected official, you have the right to do business, absolutely. But the people also have a right to protest that business. You have to find a middle ground. Yeah. So, yeah, you do need to keep control of the meetings, but you still need to allow those protests to happen.
Here's something that's interesting, I think. Jim Puckett suggested that ICE agents who attended the county commission meeting would be given the chance to directly respond to activists and address their concerns face-to-face after the meeting. This no pun intended here. Wouldn't their presence there be chilling? I mean, would people want to talk to ICE? Seriously.
Some. Absolutely. I guarantee you the reporters in the room would.
And Braxton Winston, who's one of the activists who came to, you know, saw the article saying that he was making these calls for ICE, and he has been at all sorts of protests, live streaming, camera in the face, confronting. So, yeah, he probably would have loved that opportunity.
Although the implication there that ICE agents actually set some sort of policy is really an incorrect notion. I mean, and that's the problematic thing is ICE agents just enforce a law that's already been passed by Congress and signed by the president. They're just doing their job. So I don't think they're the people that you want discussing this policy.
So how do you, as Jim Puckett suggests, maintain a proper level of civil discourse when there are people who have major beefs with what's going on in the country? How do you do it?
I think that's what local security is all about. We have the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department. We have sheriff's deputies. If the crowd gets out of hand, you just escort people out. But there was an implicit threat by mentioning ICE that we don't want undocumented people coming here raising a racket.
And let's not forget that right here in Charlotte at a city council meeting, when they were discussing whether or not to pass this little city ordinance that would expand protections for LGBTQ individuals, you had, over 140 people speak for 2 minutes each representing different points of view, and there was never, ever the need to stop business. I think the first way you do it is actually what the Charlotte City Council did that night. You tell people, okay, we're going to expand the rules. Everyone will get a chance to speak, and then they will feel like they've been heard. Because when they shut down the city council meeting the other day, it's because they weren't being allowed the chance to talk.
There are several stories that are now beginning to emerge, personal stories about people who have been affected by this new immigration policy. And one of them involves a student at Northwest School of the Arts, Ann.
Yes. His name is Gus Zamudio. He is a senior. He was arrested and charged with embezzling about $2,900 from the Myers Park Harris Teeter where he works. And when he was booked into the Mecklenburg County Jail, as we've talked about, they checked his immigration status, and he is from Mexico, and he is not documented. So he was taken to an ICE detention center in Georgia. He has a hearing this morning. He has gotten a lot of support. His lawyer says that he didn't do what he's charged with. Under the Obama administration's regulations, he would have been eligible for deportation if he was convicted. Under the new system, the fact that he has been charged makes him potentially a criminal who could be deported. So,
isn't that against the Constitution? You're innocent until proven guilty. Can that be?
But I think the argument is that you're also here illegally. So, you know, we're not just walking up to you on the street, but at the point that you did something that got you hauled to jail, now our eyes are on you and we're going to deport you. But really strong support from his school community, from activists who are saying, this isn't right. This is an 18-year-old young man, by all accounts, you know, well-liked at his school. There are people who went from Charlotte. They were live streaming there this morning. He is facing a hearing on whether he will get to come back to Charlotte until his actual deportation hearing or whether he will be held a few hundred miles from his family and friends indefinitely.
Nick.
Well, and that hearing happened, according to your colleague, Michael Gordon at The Observer. Yes, it happened this morning. It's a bond detention hearing, and he was denied bond.
So he stays in Georgia.
But let's go back to the constitutional aspect of this. I know that the new rule says even if you are charged with the crime, you are a criminal and you're going if you're here with no documentation. But isn't anybody in the country supposed to be given due process?
Well, there's different levels of due process. It's not quite as cut and dry as you're laying out.
Okay.
What he's being deported for is a crime that, you know, being in the country illegally, not the alleged embezzlement.
And the due process would be the deportation hearing, right?
Yeah, but he, you know, honestly, right now with the new guidance, we talked about this the other night at the public conversation, Mike, that we had on immigration. Under new guidance, it looks like the Trump administration is looking for expedited deportations, which would literally circumvent the immigration courts. And that is problematic because that does, even the courts say, remove due process.
I only have a couple of seconds. How long has he been in the country?
I don't know.
We don't know. Okay. When we come back, we'll talk about the repeal and replace of Obamacare and also the efforts to repeal HB 2, which continue, and efforts to end the toll lanes on I-77. It's the weekly local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. And that explains the presence of Tom Bullock from WFAE News and Nick Oxner from WBTV News and Oz Helms from the Charlotte Observer and Glenn Birkins, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Repeal and replace has been a mantra and a promise for the GOP members of Congress and candidates for office when it comes to Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act. And they've been talking about it for years. Now we know what they want to replace it with. What has been the overwhelming reaction? Who would like to take that?
I can take that. Concern, I think, is a fair one. Questions is another fair one. What you have to realize is this bill that's rolling through right now, the replacement bill, has not been scored yet by the Congressional Research Office, basically to look at how much it would cost and how many people would be affected, potentially lose coverage or potentially gain coverage.
But the American Medical Association, AARP, and another organization.
The American Hospital Association.
Has said this is very, very bad.
And pretty much everyone else.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the funny thing here is there was this really strange moment, and I say that in all fairness, where President Donald Trump said, fixing health care, who knew it was so complicated? Well, if you go back to the creation of the Affordable Care Act, Democrats could sure tell you that. And this process of this bill, it's going through wicked fast. I mean, the Democrats had, what, 160-some committee meetings about it. It went on, debate went on for over a year. We're looking to see this bill actually get passed by both the House and Senate, potentially in a matter of about 2 months.
I don't think it's going to get passed in its current form by the Senate.
Well, and that's something else we can talk about. But on the budget line that they're talking about, the method that they're using, it could be done that quickly. But here's basically one of the key differences. Right now in the exchanges, people get a subsidy based on income, and that helps cover the cost of insurance premiums. That goes away, and it's replaced by between $2,000 and $4,000 of tax credits that you get based on your age.
How does that work? They've been throwing around these tax credits now for a week or two. How does that work? If I don't know what the exact numbers are, but if you are a person who makes $30,000, $35,000 a year and you have a family of four and you participate in their version of health care and you get a tax credit, I'm going to put a number on it, it's not accurate, of $16,000.
That's not accurate.
Not even close.
Here it
what
is. Do you get?
It doesn't. Everything that you just stated there is completely irrelevant to the new plan because it's all based on age. So if you're, let's say, a 20-something, let's say you're 28, so you're no longer able to stay under your parents' insurance, which is still included in this plan, you get about $2,000. The insurance premium is what the insurance premium is. So that $2,000 won't come close to it.
So that $2,000, does that mean you simply pay $2,000 less in taxes or you get a check?
I believe you get a check. It's a rebate. It's based on the taxes that you pay.
But it would come at tax time, right? As opposed to now the subsidies, which are technically tax credits, but they get paid directly to the insurance company.
Right.
So if you're getting a good subsidy, you're getting a very small bill.
And your premium could be anywhere from, what, $150 to $900, $1,000 a month.
Well, and here's another thing that's really interesting. There's been this long push by Republicans in particular to break down the walls of insurance coverage states, right, to be able to buy insurance across state lines. Now, that's fascinating for a couple of reasons, but the prominent thing to remember is this. For a long time, basically since Ronald Reagan was president, the Republican Party has been the party of not just small government, but local control. Now, what you're going to see if this goes through and you eliminate these barriers, the elected insurance commissioners of each state – won't have the ability to control the insurance premiums in that state because you could sell it or buy it from anywhere. So you could see this rush of insurance companies to the states with the lowest regulatory burdens and the cheapest rate of doing business. And basically, they'll sell it all from there. So it could be this race to the bottom.
There will be clear winners and clear losers in this bill. Clear losers will be people on the low-income side of the equation. Clear winners will be people who make more. Under the current system, because it is income-based, if you make above a certain amount, you may get no subsidy. Mm-hmm. Under this new plan, you will definitely get a tax credit.
How is this going to work politically? If you are correct, Glenn, that this is going to hurt people who are poor, and they're the people being helped by Obamacare, and it's going to help people who are rich who don't really need the help in the first place, how does this jive with how Donald Trump got elected? People, middle Americans, who are having a tough time making it, who elected him to save them. How does this work?
I think the reason that you're seeing the consternation in the Republican Party goes exactly to what you're talking about. I think if many of the supporters of this plan truly had their druthers, they would just repeal Obamacare. But they know that that is political suicide. Mm-hmm. So they have to replace it with something. Is this going to be enough to keep those Trump supporters happy? I don't know. I would be surprised. One of the things that will go that under the current plan will go by the wayside is mandatory treatment for drug addiction. Mm-hmm. And as you know, there is an opioid epidemic in many of the areas where Trump won biggest in the South.
And yet that affects not only poor people, it affects middle class and upper middle class people.
But they're better able to take care of it within the bounds of private resources.
Well, the American Medical Association came out against it, as we said, saying it would result in millions of Americans losing coverage and benefits while making coverage more expensive, if not out of reach, for poor and sick Americans. So some GOP governors are opposing this. What has North Carolina's delegation to Congress had to say about this?
Well, Richard Burr, said it's a good first step. Senator Tom Tillis says he's looking for it. He's looking at it. You don't see a whole bunch of, you can go through the members of the House of Representatives. They haven't said a huge amount, although I'm very curious to see what Mark Meadows says about it, because he is a founding member of the Freedom Caucus. And here's one of the other things about this new health care law or bill. The budget hawks, the Tea Partiers, the Rand Paul libertarians are all super concerned about how much this is going to cost. And again, we don't know how much this is going to cost, because with love or hate Obamacare, the individual mandate, which goes away in this, at least had a funding mechanism. Right. If you did not have insurance, you paid a tax penalty. That helped fund the whole thing. With that going away and these tax credits, it's not clear how they're going to pay for it. And that's why people like Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky have said this is nothing more than a new entitlement program.
And if poor and working class people lose insurance, that has ripple effects. Even if you could ensure that all of the estimated 10 million people who would lose it are Democrats who would never vote for Donald Trump or these senators, that's why you start seeing the American Hospital Association and the AMA saying, whoa, hold up, this is not going to be good for anybody.
This is fundamentally Paul Ryan's bill, is that correct?
No. I don't think that's correct. Okay. He's got the hard slog now of selling this. I think there are key provisions on it that he has obviously supported for quite some time. But I think what you're seeing here is an amalgam of bits and bobs of other bills all pasted together to try to get something done quickly.
I think the perception is certainly that he's a driving force behind the bill. In fact, some people have started calling it Ryan Care, and the White House has sent word out that we definitely don't want to call Trump care.
But it will be.
It will be,
if it passes and it's not liked, it will become Trump care. And Donald Trump, said three major things over time about Obamacare: that it was a disaster, that it needed to be repealed and replaced in a way that everyone would be affordably insured. He also said, who knew that health care would be so complicated. Does this bill, if enacted, and likely to become Trump care if it does become enacted, does it accomplish what the president has promised?
No, I don't think it does. And I think it goes back to his third point, that this is just so complicated, right? And so I think it replaces Obamacare, but I don't think it does so in a way that ensures that everyone's affordable. But you have to, there is a recognition, I think, and a legitimate recognition that Obamacare and the model upon which it was created is not working. We see insurance companies pulling out of exchanges, you know, North Carolina.
But it's not working. The argument can be made that it's not working because of Republican obstructionism. The states that don't have state exchanges, the states who didn't expand Medicaid, that is where.
You could also argue that it's not working, and I'm not taking a position on this. I'm just going to play devil's advocate for you here on the public airwaves. We'll see how that goes. you could say that it's not working because of economics. I mean, you have health insurance companies like here in North Carolina, where most counties in North Carolina are down to just one insurer in the exchange. The other, and that's Blue Cross Blue Shield
made a profit in North Carolina this year, despite all of this.
But they're saying, because we know that businesses aren't going to keep doing things where they're going to lose money, right? And so Blue Cross Blue Shield has said, hey, look, we don't know how much longer we can do this. Right. And so that comes down to, if they're not making money, they're not going to do it. And we're seeing that play out across the country.
Glenn.
When you say that Obamacare failed, I'm not sure that's entirely
accurate.
The
model upon which it was based, and that is largely includes these
I think
exchanges.
It failed in some areas and it succeeded in some areas.
Sure.
I think it succeeded in getting more people signed up. If we're honest, it has slowed the growth of health care costs. So it has succeeded in some important areas. Where it has not succeeded are those areas where you're talking about.
Tom.
One of the key things here, and I think this is what Nick is getting at, is actually a bit of both. He's right and you are right in this, Mike, mm-hmm. and that is the fact that at some point everybody on Capitol Hill knew that there were tweaks that needed to be made to the law in order to make sure that health insurance companies were receiving their proper subsidies, because they get subsidies in this as well. The Republicans refused to pass that. They refused to make the changes. So you go back to every major entitlement program in American history, and you see this tweak that happens about 3 to 5 years after it was created in order to make sure it's running as intended. Instead of seeing that the entire time, all we have seen is a series of 67, I think, attempts to repeal it, and no actual move to try to fix what everybody knew had to be fixed as it went along.
And
I think the bottom line is that healthcare is always going to be extraordinarily expensive to someone. And there are a good number of people who would argue that the only way to make it less extraordinarily complicated is to go to a sort of single payer Medicare for everybody system, like you would see in many other industrialized countries.
That's
never going to happen with the Republican administration.
Okay, let's just talk about something else that's attempting to be repealed again. North Carolina HB2. John Bradford, a second-term Republican House member from Cornelius, has been in the middle of efforts to reach compromise. House Bill 186, mm-hmm. Nick, has been proposed as a compromise. Governor Cooper says it's not enough. He's called for a clean repeal. Give us the particulars.
Well, so the real new part about this week is that Roy Cooper has come out and said that, one, he would be in favor of House Bill 186 if it lost that provision that required local non-discrimination ordinances, like the one that was passed in Charlotte, be eligible to be put to a referendum. So that's been the sticking point.
So explain that. Go ahead.
So House Bill 186 says local cities can pass their own non-discrimination ordinances, but if they do, they have to wait in the current version of 186, you'd have to have a 90-day period where voters could call for a referendum, and you could do that by getting 10% of registered voters in the city to sign off and say we want a referendum. And then the non-discrimination ordinance would go for an up or down vote. That has been the sticking point between Democrats, you know, Roy Cooper and most Democrats, and Republicans who are pushing 186. But the governor has now come out and said, look, I support 186 without the referendum provision. And we also saw earlier this week the governor come out and recognize, because the referendum provision is important, because that's what Republicans want in order to get the bill passed, the bill to repeal HB2. That's what Republicans say. We have to have that in order to get enough Republicans on board to get it through the Republican caucus, which is important for the leaders who, you know.
So why would Democrats be opposed to that ultimately? I mean, I know they want a clean repeal, but why not make that compromise?
The argument is based on this simple premise, which, and again, I'm not advocating, but this is the argument that's been put forward. When you're talking about minority rights, you protect minority rights because that's what we do with the Constitution. It's kind of, you know, the core idea of America. Putting popular putting minority rights issues to popular votes is not what we do. Imagine what would have happened in the South if you had that a popular vote in segregation. That's a common argument that's been made.
Okay. The clock is ticking, though. Republican John Bradford, whose suggestion this is, House Bill 186, one of the few members of his party to admit that you cannot, this is a quote, you cannot underestimate the economic impact it's had on the state. But the clock is ticking because the NCAA and the ACC have to know something about HB2. They're not bringing those games back unless it's repealed. What's the time frame?
Monday, really.
Yeah.
I mean, frankly, then that's the timeline we're working off of. Things have been very quiet this week. Last week, you saw a lot of bomb throwing back and forth. Things have been very quiet. The governor and the speaker and the president pro tem of the Senate all met on Monday at the governor's mansion. They had talks that have been described as productive, but then we haven't seen anything.
So is this liable to happen before Monday? And if it doesn't happen and they have to make their decisions at the ACC and we're locked out, does that end any chance of a repeal?
Well, yes. If sporting events go away, I think Republicans are just going to throw their hands up and not want to do anything.
Is that what they want? Is that the plan?
That's a good question. Hard to say. Okay. Who knows what anyone wants, Mike?
All right. When we come back, we're going to talk about I-77 and the toll lanes and the attempt to get rid of those. And we'll talk about who's not running for mayor. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with Glenn Birkins, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com, and Doss Helms, with the Charlotte Observer, Nick Oxner from WBTV News, and Tom Bullock from WFAE News. Toll lane construction on I-77 obviously underway. Its ugly tentacles are creeping into downtown Charlotte. Because it's a
just,
mess.
I think
on
you just wrote a traffic noir novel.
But still, two Mecklenburg County lawmakers are trying to stop it. John Bradford, a Cornelius Republican, and Charlotte Democrat Chaz Beasley want to terminate the contract with I-77 Mobility Partners. That's the American name put on Cintra, which is the Spanish company that will be running this for 50 years. At this stage of construction, does this have a ghost of a chance of happening, Nick?
Probably not. And it really doesn't have anything to do with the phase of construction that we're in. It has more to do with the legislative will to come in and meddle. So this bill is another, you know, good attempt by Mecklenburg County lawmakers doing what they say they were going to do. And Chaz Beasley in his first term ran on being an opponent of the toll lanes, and he's going and he's working with Republicans and trying to cancel the contract. Maybe it'll go through the House. Maybe. We know last session that Senator Phil Berger, who runs the Senate, was not interested in canceling the contract and would not entertain that legislation. However, the thing that we should that has a better chance of being successful to reach the same ends is an effort that was launched last week in the Senate by Senator Jeff Tart, mm-hmm. also of Mecklenburg County, and some others, a bipartisan group of people who put their name on this letter to State Auditor Beth Wood, asking her to take another look at the process. Well, not another, a first look at the process by which the I-77 toll lanes contract was bid and awarded. That letter was sent to Wood last week. Wood has said that she will likely undertake a review. And so what they're trying to do, instead of just passing a bill that would cancel the contract says that it can be canceled for cause without any penalty to the state. And so basically the hope of the senators that have asked the auditor to undertake this review is that in undertaking the review, she finds some irregularities in the bidding process and the way it was awarded and the way it's been executed. And that way you would have cause to cancel the contract.
So if they canceled the contract, that would not be the end of the toll lane necessarily. It would
Correct.
Simply go to another company, or the state would take over the operation of it?
The state would take it over and could probably bid it out again to someone else. They could just bid it to a company to get it built and then they could operate it.
So for those people hoping that this will just go away, all hope is lost?
I don't think there's not going to be a toll lane there. I think what the fight right now is to get that toll lane maybe operated by the State Turnpike Authority and not by a Spanish company.
Meanwhile, NCDOT announced it's going to evaluate the lane construction corridor for safety issues because of an increase in crashes. How many crashes and where? And is this unusual in a construction area where all the lanes are being rerouted and the highway being narrowed through the center of a major city?
Well, so it's an increase of 400 crashes over the last, I don't remember the period, I don't know, since construction began, more or less. That's like above the baseline number of crashes you would expect to see. So DOT says that, well, this is pretty normal when you see a construction zone like that. Of course, the I-77 opponents say that, well, this is what happens when you shift the lanes and you don't pave over the grooves in the road from where the lane markings used to be. And so DOT has come in and said, well, we're going to take another look, we might lower the speed limit, we might try to do some other things. But so the toll road opponents, who have been saying since the construction started that there are some unsafe things like too much dust flying up from the construction down the median, you know, we need to have more dust control and you need to pave the lane so we're not, you know, driving in the grooves. Right. And DOT saying, well, this can probably be fixed by some other things.
Yeah, and one thing I would say, and I speak from experience on this, my wife was involved in a crash on I-77 during construction, and I mean, it was a minor one, but, you know, what happened there is, I think, probably more indicative than just the problem with dust, which is it's a construction zone, so you will see at random times random slowdowns or stops of traffic. Mm-hmm. If people aren't paying close attention, that's where you start getting these fender benders. And that's exactly, I mean, my wife got hit, car just wasn't paying attention and ran into the back of it.
Meanwhile, we talked last week about the delay of the opening of the Lynx Blue Line to the university area from August of this year to March of 2018. Katz now says they don't yet know whose fault the delay is. How can that be?
Government.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a couple of steps here. You have to realize, too, that the Blue Line is not being built from point A to point B. To try to speed up the process, it's basically being built from three sections out. So you have different contractors along the way. This is also a pretty complicated process. You're not just building on an open field. You're building through a city. Mm-hmm. So you've got utilities that need to be moved. You have rights of way that need to be gained. You have, you know, all kinds of different things that can happen. So what Katz needs to do is try to figure out where the slowdowns happened. And if that, when they do that, there are potentially some financial penalties they can put on the main subcontractor. But even those, you never know, because it's all negotiated out.
6 months from now, there will be a primary for mayor in Charlotte.
Didn't we just have an election?
In September. And Jennifer Roberts is obviously running for re-election, but there are also two Democrats running against her, and now one Republican. One of the Democrats is Mayor Pro Tem Vi Lyles. The other is State Senator Joel Ford. How unusual is it for Democrats to run against an incumbent Democrat mayor in a primary?
I think this is not unusual when you see the climate, the political climate in Charlotte right now.
Correct.
I think over the last year or so, you've seen Mayor Jennifer Roberts take a lot of heat. The way she handled the riots is really when the heat got turned up a lot. She's also, from some parts of her party, taken heat over the non-discrimination ordinance and the way she's handled HB2. And so I think you see this is the dissatisfaction within her own party over how she's done as mayor.
Yeah, and if I can add to that, let's not forget that she's a first-term mayor. Mm-hmm. You tend to see primary challenges to incumbents in their first term, because it's basically a referendum on, are you really happy with this mayor? So I'm not surprised at all to see a number of Democrats hop in. I wouldn't be surprised to see potentially another one jump in. At that point, when you start getting four, that's a really crowded primary for mayor.
It only helps the incumbent.
So have they have Vi Lyles and Joel Ford talked about why they're running against Mayor Roberts?
You know, in those typically veiled ways. They never say, you know, we don't think she's doing a great job, but what they do say is, we could do better.
Well, Kenny Smith has talked about it. Kenny Smith is the Republican from on the city council from District 6, who has the endorsement of the man who lost against Jennifer Roberts, Edwin Peacock. I'm curious. He said that she has been paying too much attention to state politics and not enough to the city, and that is obviously an HB2 reference. What else has he said?
He has also said she's vulnerable based on the reaction to the riots, even though he has not really taken a different stance on that. I think, you know, the city of Charlotte is skewed toward Democrats, so they tend to have a great advantage in the mayoral elections, although we remember that Pat McCrory, you know, who was last elected in 2007, at that point we'd had Republicans.
14 years of them.
And I think he's just figuring there's so much turmoil and so much churn and the national scene being what it is that maybe it's time for a Republican.
Glenn. I think the Charlotte's demographics have changed tremendously since Pat McCrory was mayor. I think the political climate has changed tremendously since then. I think Smith will have a very hard time defeating the Democrat, whoever that Democrat is, assuming that person's reasonably competent.
Is that why there's only one Republican running against?
Absolutely.
Well, but if I'm Kenny Smith and I'm looking at how relatively successful Edwin Peacock was against Jennifer Roberts, obviously not successful enough to have won, but a very, you know, pretty thin margin that he lost by. You think that if the nominee is Jennifer Roberts again, then this is someone that I have a chance of beating.
Why wouldn't he run again then against her?
He says right now he's happy with Kenny Smith running. And here's the thing. I mean, we talk about this razor-thin margin in a city that has a Democratic advantage over Republicans of, I believe, 2-1. Yeah, like, not a rough 2-1, like 2-1. You know, Edwin Peacock lost to Mayor Roberts by about 5 points. That's not, I mean, that is razor thin in a city where you should be seeing double-digit wins. So there is an undercurrent. And I honestly want to throw one other thing out that hasn't directly been talked about with mayors, and that's simple. You can look at everything, whether it's HB2 or the I-77 toll lane contracts, all these different things, it comes down to a broken relationship with Raleigh. Mm-hmm. The Charlotte-Raleigh war is hot right now.
Right.
And you could also argue, and I would be amazed if this is not an argument that you hear on the campaign trail, we have a Republican say, Republican could try to fix this. Democrats haven't done it. They've only made it worse. We need to get along with Raleigh. Better things will happen if we do.
Okay. Ann, Project Lift. We have to talk about this. Their report card came out recently. It's a mixed bag. Some of the leaders of Project Lift, including the major funding organization, on the program a couple of days ago. And they were not unhappy with this because they have said that the state standards have changed over time, so it's difficult to compare apples to apples. And when you look at improved graduation rates at West Charlotte High School, they're succeeding. When you look at the growth of students, they still may not be reading or performing at grade level, but they're having to catch up sometimes 2 to 3 grade levels, and so their progress is measurable. But evidently, the year-round school component of this is not showing measurable returns.
Right, and that's one of the reasons, and I've said this before, I give Project Lift a lot of credit for having actual research done, because anything you try to track does get so complicated. Mm-hmm. You have things change, so year to year is hard to measure. It is hard to measure school against school. Obviously, we would all love it if what they are seeing with the graduation rates where, you know, they're so close that the only question is at the end of 5 years, are they going to have met this audacious goal or just gotten really close to it? If all the measures were like that, boy, this would be, you know, a really great story to report. The proficiency measures are much lower, and one of the things that they did was to say, well, let's try to fight summer learning loss by, in two schools, keeping the same number of days but spreading out the breaks so they're not gone as long, so they don't slide in their reading or math or spelling skills. And at two other schools, they said, well, our donors are going to put up $2 million a year to have them have 19 extra days, which just, I didn't think it would work miracles. I would have placed bets that it would show more measurable progress. And again, what Project Lift would say is our 9 schools are among the most challenged in Charlotte-Mecklenburg, if not the most challenged. Mm-hmm. We picked the 4 worst, if you want to use that term, of those schools. And we threw this at it. And this private research firm that looked at comparable students, they're not just saying, hey, they're not doing as well as the kids in Ballantyne. They're saying, we made the best comparison we can to see what actual gains came from these year-round calendars, and we can't find anything conclusive.
Wow. You also reported this week that CMS's revamped magnet lottery, designed to make more options available, isn't exactly working that way.
Well, it did get more applicants, and there are more students who have been placed so far. There are also more of them, substantially more of them, on the waiting list, and that's because of the socioeconomic priority that they have said that we're going to try to get a balance of low, medium, and high socioeconomic kids in our magnet programs. And so if they ran the first lottery and 100 seats were set aside for high socioeconomic status kids and they only got 50 applicants, right now they're holding those 50 seats for another round. You get another chance to come back and say, maybe I want in this. And if that second round goes through and there are not enough to fill the designated seats for whatever group, then they'll pull from any group.
So in 30 seconds or less, CMS posted new school diversity ratings using census data on family income, single-parent homes, English as a second language, parent education levels, and home ownership to balance school populations. What might these new school ratings change?
They are going to play, I think, almost certainly, although it hasn't been spelled out, in these decisions that are coming up about boundaries. And that's why, even though this is sort of an obscure data point right now, there are a lot of people watching it with a great deal of concern to say, what is this going to mean to my neighborhood school?
Well, the yellow light is showing, and because their red light cameras might be coming back, we have to stop. Maybe we can talk about the return of red light cameras next week on this program. Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Nick Oxner from WBTV News, almost the whole show, I didn't get your name right. Nick Oxner, reporter from WBTV News, Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com, and Ann Doss-Helms from the Charlotte Observer. Thank you all for the hour.
Thanks.